Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 265, The Polyvagal Theory, with Dr. Stephen Porges. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
So if we're in a state of fight, flight, mobilize, our ability to be friendly, to be social, and even to be appropriately evaluative of others is going to be compromised. And we don't recognize this in both our educational and even in our medical clinical world. We don't realize that the person's physiological state is really the window, the portal to both learning and treatment modalities, whether we're talking about psychotherapy, body therapies, or basic practice of medicine. We want to create physiological states that recruit neural circuits that not only support social behavior, but support health growth and restoration. And the beauty of the model is that the same circuits involved in social behavior, social engagement system, are also the same circuits that are involved in health growth and restoration.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Stephen Porges, speaking about what he has termed the polyvagal theory. Stephen W. Porges, Ph.D., is professor of psychiatry and bioengineering and director of the Brain Body Center at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His work on the autonomic nervous system has led to a new understanding of mechanisms involved in behavioral regulation and social engagement behaviors. He is developing new biobehavioral assessment tools to monitor individual differences in physiological regulation of behavioral states. His research has led to an innovative intervention, the Listening Project, designed to exercise the neural regulation of middle ear structures to reduce auditory hypersensitivities and to improve the ability to listen to and to attend to human speech. Dr. Porges speaks throughout the world about his polyvagal theory and its applications to typical and clinical populations. He is the author of the 2011 book, The Polyvagal Theory, Neurophysiological Foundations of Emotions, Attachment, Communication, and Self-Regulation. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Stephen Porges, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm really happy to have this opportunity to meet with you and to discuss your work. I got a kick out of discovering that we have some things in common. We both went to graduate school in Michigan, you at Michigan State, me at the University of Michigan. We both got our PhDs in the same year. And interestingly, we both did research as graduate students on attention. You on attention in relation to the heart, and me in relation to altered states of consciousness.
So that's very interesting. But I will say one thing, that you're probably a lot smarter than me because you're not in the Midwest now, are you?
Well, if that's going to be the measuring stick, that's probably the only one that I would come out ahead on. You really continued with a career in research, and you know, I was just trying to get out of graduate school, so I didn't follow up on my research into attention. But it's interesting to see how in the intervening years, since way back then in the dawn of time, attention has really emerged to be a central concern of research. And at the time that you and I were mucking about with it, there weren't any, you know, we didn't have any of the brain correlates, no good ways to measure attention at that time.
Now, it's quite interesting because it really was a William James construct. And so that was about as clearly as it was defined was in William James in the late 1800s and early 1900s. But maybe a good point to start with is, how did I get from attention into polyvagal? Is that something you might find of interest?
Yeah, that sounds great. Go ahead, tell us that.
I don't mean to lead the interview, but it really is a kind of an interesting story, because like many of us, we were very interested in cognitive function and looking for other indicators of cognition. So if you could put electrodes on a person, you wouldn't have to ask them if they were attending. You could actually look at the physiological patterns. And when I was doing this, I actually observed a very unique phenomenon, and that was when people started to sustain their attention, the heart rate pattern started to become more stable. So the beat-to-beat changes in heart rate were reduced. And this was quite an interesting phenomenon, because it was statistically powerful, and it was non-discriminatory regarding the types of attention. So it was like reflecting an attentive state. And I got very excited by this, but no one quite understood what was the mechanism of this change in heart rate variability. And then I noticed that people who had larger responses, meaning that they stabilized their heart rate more and had faster reaction times, and these were the same people who, when they were in a relaxful state, had more beat-to-beat heart rate variability. And that started the journey of trying to figure out what was that beat-to-beat heart rate variability all about. And that's how the polyvagal theory started.
Okay, well, you've put the polyvagal theory on the table, and of course you've got a new book just came out called The Polyvagal Theory, and you're widely known for this theory. And so I think a good place for us us to start would be with the word polyvagal. Poly, to me, suggests many, and many listeners will know that there's something called the vagus nerve, but maybe not much more. So tell us, what does polyvagal refer to?
Okay, it was actually, as you've already come up with, a description that what people were calling vagus or vagal tone or vagal activity was really a nondescript term. It was too ambiguous because there were multiple vagal pathways. And it also forgot or left out of the equation the most important part of the whole vagal circuit, and that is the sensory or afferent component, the part that's bringing all the information from our body up to the brain. So polyvagal was really, the term was coined to appreciate the fact that when you're measuring vagal activity, it could come from different areas in the brain, and it could be reflecting information coming up from the body.
Well, listeners will be familiar with the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems that make up the autonomic nervous system. I don't recall that we used to hear much about a vagal system in the past. What's the relationship between the vagal system and the autonomic system?
The vagus is the primary pathway for the parasympathetic nervous system. So most of the parasympathetic activity to our viscera comes through the vagus. It's a large meandering nerve, and that's why it was called the vagus. It was because it was vagabond. It was moving around.
Hmm.
And actually, we're going to get to another point, because when we look in the brainstem, the motor fibers were thought to come out of one area called the dorsal motor nucleus of the vagus. But when people started to study comparative neuroanatomy and the technologies became better over the last, two or three decades, they found out that in mammals, there were vagal pathways coming from another nucleus, and that one was called nucleus ambiguus. So now you have a vagabond nerve that comes from an ambiguous site.
Great.
But the beauty of this whole circuit is when you start understanding about what's coming out of this area, nucleus ambiguus, it really creates a heart-face connection. It's an area that controls many of the activities of motor fibers regulating muscles of the face and head. So that's why when people speak with different intonation, they're telling you really about their visceral state. They're telling you whether they're calm or anxious. And as attentive clinicians, you already know that. But there's a true physiology to that.
Boy, that's really fascinating. Now, part of the story involves the myelination of the nerves. And so talk to us about that and the implications for our experience.
There are two parts. If we look phylogenetically, so look at the evolutionary history of where we came from, And we have actually, we evolved from reptiles, okay? That's part of our history. But at the transition from reptiles to mammals, there are many interesting things that are occurring that are intricately related to social and emotional regulation. One is that mammals have this unique myelinated vagus that is no longer being regulated from the dorsal motor nucleus of the vagus, but now from nucleus ambiguous. They're actually during embryology and during development, the source nuclei migrate, but that's really irrelevant to what most people want to know about. The issue is the myelinated fibers are really fibers that work very, very rapidly. They communicate quickly. They are tightly regulated. And what those myelinated vagal fibers are capable of doing, they're capable of inhibiting sympathetic activity and calming us down. So the issue is that what we often are doing is we have what I call a vagal break. And this is this myelinated vagus that sits on top of the sympathetic nervous system and can calm us down and slow our heart rate up or make us calm. But we can rapidly retract the vagal break without stimulating the sympathetic. So we can have increased metabolic activity. We can stand up. We can sit down. We can shake hands. We can look at people without really triggering sympathetic activity. So an understanding of the myelinated vagal system and the vagal break shifts our conceptualization from a sympathetic parasympathetic balance model, meaning that if you needed more heart rate, you stimulate the sympathetics, to a model that says this is all put together hierarchically and that you have a system that is basically a governor, a brake upon a metabolic motion system which requires sympathetics. And when we take this brake away, we then have this opportunity to mobilize very efficiently. But when we're in safe situations, we don't want this massive engine to be fired up.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the face. You said that the theory has two important parts, and the first is the link between the nerves of the face and the nerves that regulate heart and lungs. Yeah. So let's start with that first part about the face and hearing and heart and lungs. Tell us about that.
If we think about what we know in terms of our social interactions, all this becomes extraordinarily intuitive. So that when we see people whose faces are flat, meaning they're not exuberant, they're not smiling, they often are not speaking with much intonation either. The voice tends to be monotonic. They don't use expressivity. They tend to gravitate towards either lower frequencies if they're males. If they're females, they get to be high-pitched, non-modulated sounds. If we look at so the face is flat, the voice is monotone, and they often, if you talk to them, they often aren't really, you would say, listening to you. So their eyes may roll up. They may not be processing what you're saying. And the point of all that is that the nerves that regulate the striated muscles of the face and head are all linked in the brainstem to an area that controls this myelinated vagus. And if we think in terms of our evolutionary history, what was this all about? It was all about conveying to conspecifics whether we were physiologically safe to come close to. So if our heart rate is calm, modulated by this vagal break, then the vocalizations will have prosody, then we'll be able to hear what people are saying, and then we'll be expressive. If we're in a physiological state that supports defensive fight-flight behaviors, then our face looks different, our ability to extract information through the acoustic channels changes, and we're conveying to the other person, the conspecific, if it's not a person, another mammal, that we should not be someone that we should cuddle with. So it's this face-heart connection which evolved really as a transparent social communication, it made our viscera transparent to conspecifics. And something has been lost along the way. We've given up, in a sense, our natural intuition about people, and we start to get very cognitive and start using words or syntax. And I guess one of the take-homes of this discussion will be that it's really not what people are saying, it's how they say it that affects other people.
Yeah, of course, that's near and dear to my heart as a clinician. Now, going back to the second part of your theory, you and I think you've touched on this, you say that there's a phylogenetic hierarchy that describes the evolutionary sequence from a primitive, unmyelinated vagus related to conservation of metabolic resources to a sympathetic adrenal system involved in mobilization strategies to a myelinated vagus related to modulating calm bodily states and social engagement behaviors. So there's a three-step hierarchy. Can you say a little bit more about that sequence?
Absolutely. Most of us, when we were in graduate school, and even since then when we teach, we tend to teach a paired antagonism model of the autonomic nervous system.
Right, that's what I learned.
Yeah, and it's still taught, I lecture in medical school, and they're still teaching this. And it's in part correct, but very limited, because it tells you really about the tonic tone to the target organ in the viscera. It tells you nothing about how that system will react to challenges. And that's where the clinical world is really concerned about. So the issue is, when we start to understand it from a concept of reactivity to challenge, we now move into a evolutionary theory of adaptiveness. So how does the system respond, and what are the adaptive features of that response? And what we start to see phylogenetically moving up from, functionally, from, actually we go back to the cartilaginous fish, which are the sharks and rays. They have an unmyelinated vagus. And what that does is, when the resources are minimal, so the temperature and food aren't there, they just slow up the metabolic activity. And there's no problem for their survival with that, because their nervous system is not oxygen hungry. Okay, our nervous system is oxygen hungry. We can't slow up very well. Then as you look through the evolutionary or the phylogenetic history of mammals, you start seeing that bony fish start having a spinal sympathetic nervous system very similar to what we have. So they can recruit a neural support for the motor activity that is now in balance, in a sense, with the parasympathetic. However, as we follow evolution, we have to think about the order in which these circuits come in, because we retain these circuits, and that order provides us with a hierarchy of how the circuits work. So newer circuits work first, and then older circuits are recruited. And this was a concept that was introduced in about 1900 by an English neurologist called John Hewings Jackson, and he called it dissolution, or evolution in reverse. And many of your listeners have probably read Descartes' Error, and where people talk about damage of frontal areas and cortical areas and disinhibiting older brain structures. We have to think of the autonomic nervous system as following that same dissolution model. So what it really is trying to say, that not only is the brain going through a disinhibiting older circuits, that's exactly how the autonomic nervous system works, but there are three major phylogenetically ordered circuits. So there's this old unmyelinated circuit, which is a shutdown one. And that one basically is related to reducing metabolic activity. You can see this used as a defensive system in mammals. When a cat picks up a mouse, and I'm going to rhetorically ask you, David, what happens when the cat picks up a mouse?
The mouse, I think, freezes.
Can you describe the physical features of that freezing behavior?
I'm trying to remember if I've ever seen this, but I think the mouse maybe sort of plays dead.
Right. The word is commonly used, death fading. But playing dead is not a cognitive decision. It's a physiological reflex. And we now, what you actually have illustrated in your response was the ambiguity of the word freezing. So we can freeze without motor tone, like the mouse in the jaws of the cat, or we can freeze like the deer in the headlights of a car, which has lots of motor tone. One is a sympathetic response when you have increased motor tone, but the death feigning, the loose motor tone, is the old vagal, the unmyelinated vagus. Both are defensive systems, both, but they're mediated by different neural mechanisms. Okay?
Yeah.
But the issue is, when you go into this death-feigning immobilization response, it's potentially lethal for mammals. So many of those mice that go into that death-feigning mode drop dead. 25% or more will drop dead.
They just die not because the cat clamped down its jaws. They just die.
They die because they're not supporting the oxygen needs of their brain.
Hmm.
And they basically have now a neural mechanism that resulted in a bradycardia, slowing of the heart rate, and an apnea, a reduction of breathing, and this resulted in them dying. Now, those two words, apneas and bradycardias, have you heard those floating around with another clinical population?
Let's see. There's sleep apnea. That's something I've certainly heard about.
But with preterm babies, apneas and bradycardias are the major risk factors for death. And with a preterm baby, they come into the world without the mammalian vagal system.
Oh.
They come in with a reptilian one. So their defensive system is apneas and bradycardias. Okay?
Yeah.
So phylogenetically, then the sympathetics come on, and the sympathetics turn off that vagal circuit. We use that old unmyelinated vagal circuit primarily in our body for subdiaphragmatic regulation, meaning our digestive tract. Anything below our diaphragm is primarily unmyelinated vagal function. And if you have to mobilize or run, what happens to your digestion? Does it get better or does it turn off?
It turns off.
This is an example of that phylogenetic hierarchy, that if you now need the sympathetics, you're going to inhibit that old parasympathetic. Okay?
Yes.
Now, if you are in a safe room with walls and with friendly people and intonation of voice and people feel good, then that face-heart connection will dampen that sympathetic nervous system. So you now have this, in a sense, hierarchy. But when you dampen that sympathetic nervous system, you pay a price. You pay a price because you give up many of the features that you and I learned in grad school that were associated with vigilance. We turn off our social engagement system when we are vigilant. Our social engagement system is the myelinated vagus, and it's linkage with the striated muscles of the face and head. And what that does, some of those striated muscles go to an area or are in an area called the middle ear. And what they do is they control the tension of the little bones, the ossicles, between the eardrum and the inner ear, and they change the tension on the eardrum. So it's like tuning up a kettle drum. And when this tension is tight, you have difficulty hearing low-frequency sounds. And when it's loose, you can hear low-frequency sounds extraordinarily well, but the higher-frequency sounds of human voice disappear. So you can start seeing the cost-benefit ratio occurring.
Yeah, I was really surprised to learn that we have inner ear muscles.
No, I got to correct that. Middle ear muscles. We have inner ear hair cells, but we have middle ear muscles. So don't get confused on that part.
Well, that's even further back then, right?
It's closer to the surface.
Oh, it is closer to the surface. Okay.
So the muscles, children have severe ear infections, otitis media.
Right.
That's inflammation of the middle ear. And what happens is when it's inflamed and when the infection goes away, often the neural regulation of the muscles is compromised. So many children who have otitis media often have difficulties in language skills. It's not causal, but it's related.
Okay.
Because many individuals will rehabilitate spontaneously. So the point, what I really want to make here is the middle ear muscles control what is called the transfer function of what sounds get into the inner ear and then into our brain. So it's as if the middle ear muscles are not tense, pulling those bones tight together, it's like a rubber band that's real loose and only low frequencies will come through when we ping it. But if the muscles are tense, it tightens the ossicle chain, and now higher frequencies come in. But the higher frequencies come in at the expense of dampening the low frequencies. And now I'm going to ask you a rhetorical question. What frequencies are predator associated with?
You said it was rhetorical, so that means I don't have to answer it, right?
It's a quiz, David. It's a quiz. Okay. So really, low-frequency sounds are phylogenetically wired into our nervous system to reflect predator.
So like the growling of a bear.
Growling, or earthquakes, or thunder, or for autistic kids, it will be vacuum cleaners, elevators, ventilation systems from buildings, low frequencies, airplanes. Those low frequency sounds trigger a defensive state. And when we are safe and if we can then trigger the middle ear muscles to work, we filter out those low frequency sounds. And so I'm now going to work with this. I'm going to ask you another question.
Oh,
do you have
no.
any children? Yes. Oh, yes.
I thought I had graduated.
No, you didn't just graduate. You're on the couch.
Okay.
Do you have children?
Yes, I do.
Did you have any sons, or do you have any sons?
Three of them. I've got four kids, three sons okay. and a daughter.
Okay. When they were teenagers, did your sons do anything to your car radio?
Well, they would change the settings, which would, you know, mess up my pre-programmed settings.
Okay, that's what now you're going to describe to me what they changed.
The default stations that the
radio. Oh, no, I don't mean the stations, but what do they do with the bass and treble? Do they do anything with that?
Yeah, I think they probably like to kick up the bass.
Absolutely, because they were young guys with good middle ear muscles, and they couldn't hear the bass if they were listening to human voice. Hmm. And so they were performing a psychophysics experiment in front of your eyes. They were cranking up the bass so they could hear it. But to you, when they cranked up the bass, you couldn't hear the human voice.
You know, I suffer from tinnitus. Do you have anything to say about that in terms of what's...
Well, not today. When we get finished with this, and when we're not being taped, we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Okay, but the bottom line of this is that there is an adaptive function that if you're in safe environment and your face looks animated, your middle ear muscles tend to be tense, and you have difficulty hearing low-frequency sounds because you're now able to pick up the higher frequencies of human voice. Those harmonics are conveying meaning. The problem with a lot of people, they can hear that people are speaking, but they can't hear the ends of the words. And it's those phonemes with the consonants that tell us what people are really saying.
Hmm.
And that is reserved for safe environments, because when we're in dangerous environments, we want to hear predator. So there's this dialectic occurring of what is safe and what is not safe, and how our nervous system responds to it. So the hierarchy in terms of the polyvagal theory is this phylogenetic. It's only with mammals that you have this face-heart connection that involves facial motor activity with the myelinate vagus. And that is inhibitory over the sympathetics because we really want to turn off defensive systems if we want to cuddle. Then the sympathetics will turn off digestive and subdiaphragmatic if we need to mobilize. So now you have the autonomic nervous system hierarchically organized for very, very important adaptive function.
I want to take a step back to the mouse that freezes, and I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but I've been in situations in the past where I was in relationship with a woman, and for some reason she was really tearing into me, just tearing me down. And I would freeze and just couldn't think of anything to defend myself and just really kind of go into that frozen mouse mode.
Part of it, that's actually very interesting because now we start moving into trauma and where the mammal, or let's say the human, retains some features of death fading and some other features. So often we may dissociate, we may not be able to, in a sense, utilize certain parts of our nervous system if we're not safe. Actually, now that you're describing it, it's not what you were, you didn't lose motor tone. You just probably tightened up physically and started to get, in a sense, defensive. You didn't start to pass out.
No.
Right?
No.
Okay, so what happened, this is, if we take this whole concept of defensive systems, where we have two basic categories of defense. And it's not fight or flight, it's fight-flight, because they recruit the same autonomic components. We have a fight-flight system, a mobilization system, but we also have this immobilization system. You were in more of a fight-flight, even though you weren't running, and you might have felt you couldn't run. Your sympathetic nervous system probably got triggered, and when you got into that state, the feedback from your viscera to the brainstem basically didn't enable certain cortical areas to be recruited. So
I felt dumb, you know, duh.
Yeah, you got it, right. Right, it's like what happens when we yell at kids and say, don't you know that? And the child just, you know, can't recruit anything. Because what we've done is exactly what Hewlett Jackson talked about. We have a dissolution. But he was talking about brain damage and brain disease. And what we're talking about are functional adaptive circuits that basically slide up and down that phylogenetic tree. So it's not good behavior or bad behavior. It's adapted in certain settings. And you were triggered that it was now a dangerous setting. So your nervous system was basically reading the cues, probably very accurately, and saying, this is uncomfortable. I don't really want to be here. And so you're not into a dialogue of friendly chatter. You're into a defensive mode.
Yes. Now, the beauty of your theory is that it provides insights into such seemingly disparate conditions as PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, autism, and borderline personality. And you've started talking a bit about trauma. I want us to touch each of those three areas. In one place, you refer to PTSD as preparation to be killed.
Yeah. First of all, let's kind of back off a little bit from clear-cut diagnostic categories, because diagnostic categories are totally the resultant of a consensus of a series of behavioral and psychological features. They're basically a phenotype model. And what I'm going to talk a lot about are common cores that seem to transcend diagnostic category. And in the scientific world, let me give you a pitch here. There tends to be little resource available for people who want to talk about common cores across diagnostic categories. Where the money is in specificity of disease diagnosis. So if there's a specific feature unique to autism or PTSD, then that becomes of interest. But there are mainly core features that change or at least appear to be common across many, many mental health disorders. One would be state regulation issues, behavioral and physiological state. The other one would be the facial affect is going to be different. You're going to see features even of auditory hypersensitivities across many of them. And you get the auditory hypersensitivities when those middle ear muscles aren't working right. You get the flat affect when the neural tone to the facial muscles isn't working right. You get state regulation issues when the vagal influence is not inhibiting the sympathetics. And I clustered all those systems together as a social engagement system. In a sense, there's an organizing principle that if you understand the brain regulation of the face and the heart, it all comes together. And people learned some of this when they learned neuroanatomy, and they learned about a set of pathways called special visceral efferents. And those are the pathways that control the striate muscles of the face and head, and they're linked in the brainstem to the regulation of the myelinated vagus. But let's go back to really what you're asking, and that is, you really want to talk about trauma now, right?
Yes.
Okay, so and I'm going to give you an example, and then we're going to work off of that. I was at a conference, and I was watching CNN before I had to go give a talk. And on the CNN show, it was a news part of their shows, they were videotaping or showing on the screen an airplane that was having great difficulty in landing. The wing tips were flipping side to side. It did not look pleasant. They then went down to interview the people on the airplane with the expectation the people would be describing that they were really scared and they couldn't wait to get out of the plane. They were jumping out of their skin. So the a reporter goes up to a woman and he says to her, could you please describe your experiences on the plane? And she says, experiences? I passed out. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so what does she say? She's like the mouse in the jaws of the cat. Under that setting, the cues in the environment triggered this very old, unmyelinate vagus immobilization defensive system. Did that happen to everyone in the plane with the same physical stimuli? No. Some people, of course, were screaming, couldn't wait to get out, were highly mobilized. So what I conceptualized is, I actually coined a term that I called neuroception. And neuroception is really our nervous system's constant evaluation of risk in the environment. And it is through neuroceptive processes that we shift from these different circuits. The difficulty with neuroception in our cognitive-centric world that we live in is that this is not perception. It's not an aware response. Our nervous system is doing this for very profound adaptive reasons. But we can't predict on a person-to-person basis, at least at this point, who's going to shut down or who's going to freak out and go into a panic state. And I will actually share my own personal experience with this. I went to get an MRI, and of course, in my profession, a lot of people do research in MRI.
Sure.
Okay. So I was really kind of thrilled. This is going to be a lot of fun. Okay.
Yeah, right.
I got down there and I got on the table, and they started to move me into the magnet. You know, to fold your arms over. It's a small bore, not that much room. So I got up to my forehead and I said, "Could we wait a moment? Could I get out and get a glass of water?" And I took the glass of water, went back on, and I got to my nose, and I said, "I'm out of here." I had no idea that the features in the environment would trigger in my body a defense behavior of mobilization. I basically went into a state of, as a clinician, you would call it panic, but it wasn't real panic. I knew I couldn't be there. So I said, get me out of there. I took control. So if I have to take an MRI, I get a little assist from certain types of medication. But the point I'm making is we don't even know, even those of us who study these things, we don't know what will trigger these responses. This becomes critical in the area of PTSD because people are functionally victimized when they go into states of shutdown because the clinical world had no construct of a defensive shutdown response. It thought all defense was fight or flight. And even in naming PTSD as post-traumatic stress disorder, people assumed that they would have high cortisol, they would be high sympathetic tone, all these features of mobilization. And what they found out is that many of them don't. They have low cortisol, they have low autonomic tone. So it was totally confusing to the clinical world because they didn't have the concept of a defensive system that was related to immobilization.
Yeah, one of the things that I was interested to read is that you teach them to reframe their experience to actually celebrate their body's successful survival strategy.
So if we think about what much of clinical practice is about, and also what much of education is about, it's about evaluation. And whenever we tell someone that they're not doing something right, they should do something different, we're functionally evaluating them. And what are, in a sense, the neuroceptive responses to people evaluating you? It's defensive. So how can we recruit this wonderful mammalian social engagement system if we're triggering defenses? You follow the paradox?
Yeah, and I think you've said that some of the approaches to treating PTSD are actually re-traumatizing people.
Well, they're basically keeping people in very defensive states and potentially re-traumatizing them. Okay. So if we say to a person, you know, your body has done great things for you. It saved you. You were just like the mouse in the jaws of the cat. By death feigning or by dissociating or by passing out, you were able to live through very, very difficult, unpleasant situations. The problem is that when you went into that state, it was a little bit difficult to get out of. So in a sense, people can't move out of that very easily. But let's say, let's start off by saying, let's feel good about what your body did for you. Okay? So I was giving a few workshops, and I started to incorporate this type of dialogue in the workshop. And I started to get literally floods of emails back from clinicians who were working with trauma patients. And they were telling me the power of telling their patients, their clients this, that the clients were now, in a sense, seeing themselves as, seeing the heroic component of themselves as opposed to the victim component.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue is we're so locked into the cognitions. If we start understanding how we respond to certain subtle things like, you did a great job, your body did a wonderful thing for you, as opposed to, I feel for you because you can't engage with other people. I mean, there's a difference in the intonation and in the dialogue about either evaluating the limitations of the behavior versus being sharing the joy and pride of surviving.
Yes.
As a starting point.
Yes. Yeah, I can really relate to that. So do you have any thoughts about current approaches to treating PTSD, which typically involves some sort of re-exposure to the traumatic event?
The issue, okay, you notice the gasp.
I don't mean to cause you any pain here.
I'm evaluating the cost that I will pay for making comments on your show. I would basically structure what I think would be the goal of a good therapy. A goal of a good therapy would be to be able to treat the traumatic event as if it were like an event and had no visceral component to it. The problem with repeated exposure, and this goes back to our old training in classical conditioning, where classical conditioning really was visceral conditioning. And there were even concepts back in the days when we were in grad school that were called one-trial learning.
Yes.
And trauma has to be conceptualized functionally as a one-trial learning because it's such a profound visceral shift with certain associations.
Right.
So what needs to be done is not to work on the stimulus, which is really what exposure therapy is all about, but to get people into different visceral states. So if you can recruit this social engagement system and get people, in a sense, more regulated through this myelinated vagus with the striated muscles of the face and head, they're functionally using newer circuits and able now to recruit different levels of the brain. And those higher levels of the brain are inhibitory on those lower levels where some of this trauma resides. So the strategy is not exposure, but modulation of visceral state, getting the person to be safe. Then when they're safe, they have much better or much more plasticity and flexibility to deal with a variety of stimuli.
I would imagine that a behavior therapist would argue that, in fact, that's just exactly what they're trying to do, is get the person into a relaxed state and then through successive approximations approach that scary experience, backing off as soon as they lose the relaxation.
Perhaps. What I would actually say that a lot of people think that therapy could be delivered through what they call manualization.
Yeah.
It's not the therapist that's critical, it's the delivery of the strategy. And what I'm really saying is the social engagement system is the therapist. So in a sense, the therapist's ability to modulate voice, to be appropriately attentive, and then not to be, to a sense, respect the other person's space, whether that person is a behavioral therapist or any other form of therapy, is the school therapy is almost irrelevant. It's whether or not the person has the natural skills and intuition to, in a sense, perform a neural or be part of a neural exercise with the client of this back and forth interaction of social engagement. So
Yeah, I totally agree with you, and there is a lot of research to support that point of view, that it's the person of the therapist is really important. Let's move on to talk a bit about autism, because your theory has quite a bit to say about that as well.
Yeah. With autism, what I want to focus on is a lot of the symptoms. I don't want to focus on causes. Again, autism has is a major problem, not because there's so many individuals getting the diagnosis, but because treatments are so limited in improving the quality of life for the individual and their family. There's certain things that we've been working on. We've been working on the reduction of auditory hypersensitivities, and then what happens when you reduce those. And the idea in my model with dealing with autism is if you look at the features of autism, you have a compromised social engagement system. You have lack of facial affect, you have poor eye gaze, you have auditory hypersensitivities, you have language delays often, you have lack of prosody in voice, and you also have autonomic state regulation issues. And you often see the individual sticking their fingers in their ears, and it's not because they don't want to hear you, it's because the sound that they are hearing can be painful. And if you don't have middle ear muscles working, you're being bombarded with a whole different acoustic array. So what we've been working on is whether building a model of can you engage the neural regulation of the middle ear muscles to dampen out or at least improve or reduce the severity of auditory hypersensitivities. And when you do that, what happens to the rest of the social engagement system? And this is a project that I call the Listening Project. And we've been doing this as a research project for about a decade and run a few hundred, actually over 200 individuals. And what we're seeing is that if an individual has auditory hypersensitivities, about 60% will no longer have them. After about 5 45-minute sessions, listening to acoustic stimulation that has been computer-altered with the objective of trying to engage a neural regulation of the middle ear muscles. And what that really means is that the prosodic features of the vocal music that we're using has been computer-altered to magnify the modulations. So it's as if we have a hyper-prosodic voice. Hmm. And our nervous system, in a sense, goes towards prosody.
Can you imitate that to give us a sense of what it would sound like?
My voice is very dry right now. I can't, because what it would sound like, it would sound extraordinarily melodic, but then it would sound very thin, and then it would start sounding fuller. And so the voice would appear to disappear and then come back. Hmm. And it becomes very engaging. So when you're listening to music or someone singing and it becomes very narrow and then becomes very full, we get exuberant when it gets fuller. We move towards it. Composers have always understood this in terms of how they pull in other instruments to make the frequency bands richer or narrower, softer, and louder.
Dare I admit that I'm a big fan of American Idol, and when the contestants go for that sort of big emotional push, it often brings tears to my eyes. It's very moving.
Yeah. Well, our nervous system evolved to listen for prosodic features. And so if you have a dog and you talk to a dog like that, the dog will literally go down to the ground and say, really saying to you, did I do something wrong? But if you say, come here, little girl, come here, this melodic voice conveys to all mammals that they are, you're in friendly hands, friendly places. So our nervous system knows this. This is a given. And what I'm saying is if we can refine the type of acoustic stimulation that we're providing to people who have auditory hypersensitivities, flat faces, lack of prosody, we can start triggering these circuits to work. So when the 60 of the individuals whose auditory hypersensitivities were improved with the intervention, 85% of them start to show more spontaneous social behavior. So what I'm trying to say, it doesn't mean they're not autistic. But what we're dealing with is now reducing some of the primary symptoms of autism to make the child's life better and create portals of both social communication, language development, and education.
You talk about the importance of soothing as an intervention for some psychological disorders, and that set me to wondering if you see meditation as fitting into your theory as an intervention.
Yeah, that actually I gave a talk a few weeks ago, and the talk was called safety as a transformative state, mindfulness from a polyvagal perspective. Okay? And so what the talk was really trying to say was the features of meditation, or let's use the term mindfulness meditation exercise, if we can move to that, deal with breath, deal with listening, and some may also deal with vocalizations. So these are neural exercises of the myelinated vagal system or the social engagement system. And let me now elaborate a little bit. If you exhale slowly, you're functionally enhancing the access of that myelinated vagus. So if we inhale rapidly and exhale slowly, the calmingness that we feel with that type of breathing pattern is very predictable because it's increasing the amount of the functional or neural influence of that myelinated vagus is calming. If we reverse the inspiration-expiration ratio, we can make people anxious, or where people used to know, put them into panic. So hyperventilation used to be viewed as a cue for panic. So the mindfulness breathing can be very important. The idea of listening, whether we listen to our own bodies or we listen to others, is also this neural engagement of middle ear muscle structures. But we can't listen and we can't exhale slowly unless we're in safe places.
Okay, well, that certainly makes sense. Now, before we run out of time here, I do want to touch on what the polyvagal theory has to say about borderline personality and its treatment. And again, I'm no huge fan of the DSM either, I might add, but still, it is something you've written about.
Yeah. Okay. What we've written about is the fact that we've actually studied them, and we studied them in a found something that we weren't looking for. We thought if we show borderlines and videos of different emotional scenarios, they would respond differently than control subjects. Well, that's not what the study showed. The study showed that over time, in an experimental setting, the borderline individuals start to lose their myelinated vagal control of the heart, and their heart rate starts to go very fast. In a sense, physiologically, they're ready to jump out of their skin. While the controls in exactly the same environment, over time, became calmer and calmer and calmer. More and more vagal activity, slower heart rate. And when they walked into the study, they were at the same place. And what that started to tell me was that they're taking the same physical cues in the environment, and it says we use the term neuroception, they're processing it differently. And what I realized was that we had the experimenter in the room with the subject. And for the borderline, a strange person in the room was not calming. Okay. But for a typical person, another person in the room, in a sense, was a signal to the nervous system that this was safe. And so we see that two different people, one with a clinical diagnosis and the other group without any diagnosis, respond to the same physical features in two different ways. One's going into defensive strategies, and one is going into physiological states that support social engagement. And what I want to kind of summarize this point in basically emphasize that those physiological states, whether we're talking about a shutting down unmyelinated vagal state or a sympathetic mobilization state or this myelinated vagal social engagement state, these are functionally neural platforms upon which a range of behaviors can occur or can coexist. So if we're in a state of fight-flight mobilized, our ability to be friendly, to be social, and even to be appropriately evaluative of others, it's going to be compromised. And we don't recognize this in both our educational and even in our medical clinical world. We don't realize that the person's physiological state is really the window, the portal, to both learning and treatment modalities, whether we're talking about psychotherapy, body therapies, or basic practice of medicine. We want to create physiological states that recruit neural circuits that not only support social behavior, but support health growth and restoration. And the beauty of the model is that the same circuits involved in social behavior, social engagement system, are also the same circuits that are involved in health, growth, and restoration.
One of the things we haven't talked about explicitly, but that I think is implied in what you just said, is I seem to recall from my interview with Dr. Dacher Keltner that the vagus system and oxytocin are implicated in affairs of the heart. So what about love?
Okay. Let me give the appropriate credit before I start talking. My wife is Carol Sue Carter, or C. Sue Carter. Sue is the one who discovered the relationship between oxytocin and social behavior.
Okay, I recall seeing her name now, yes.
Yeah, she's the Prairie Vole person.
Oh, yes, okay.
She developed that model. But the Prairie Vole has something very unique. It has, of course, high oxytocin levels, but it also has high myelinated vagal tone, unlike most small rodents. It has tremendous vagal activity. And when they're with their littermates, they have high vagal activity, and if you put them into isolation, they lose the vagal activity, and their heart rates now are tachycardic very fast and like mice. And when they're with their partner, it's very slow and very rhythmic. Okay, but the interesting part, and this is the part that we are working on together, because the area of the unmyelinated vagus, the dorsal motor nucleus, the vagus, is a hot spot for oxytocin. And this is critical to understand. So the area of the immobilization circuit, which I talk about only as defense, is really oxytocin sensitive. And what that means is oxytocin enables the recruitment of this old defensive immobilization circuit for reproductive and other, you know, behaviors, so that we can be next to another person and immobilized as opposed to being defensive, required phylogenetically or through evolutionary selection, oxytocin or some peptide to start regulating that immobilization circuit. If let me basically make it clear that for mammals, immobilization is dangerous. So how do we get a mammal to immobilize? And this is where oxytocin is involved. It enables the system to immobilize. This is critical for nursing, for parturition, and for reproductive behaviors.
Okay, shifting ground just a bit here. You're a pioneer in the emerging field of interpersonal neurobiology. Perhaps you could give us a sense of what's implied by that term, interpersonal neurobiology. I had the privilege of interviewing Dr. Dan Siegel not long ago, and do I recall correctly that he's also part of this interpersonal neurobiology movement?
Yeah, I would say that Dan is really the person who spearheaded this whole idea of trying to bring into psychotherapy and clinical, both psychiatry and in clinical psychology, an understanding of the nervous system to help clinicians deal with their clients. What I bring into the story is the notion of the viscera, the actual underlying part of our body, and how that influences higher brain structures, and then how higher brain structures influence our body. So what I'm really working on is expanding what I call a interpersonal neurobiology narrative that would then be helpful in both demystifying mental health disorders and then also developing strategies that would reduce symptoms and help improve outcomes.
Okay, well, we should probably wrap it up here. I'm wondering if there is any final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me. And the final thought would be that the hierarchy that's described by the polyvagal theory is extraordinarily intuitive and provides a very useful framework to understand many aspects of human behavior. We have to also realize that those circuits that were used for defense, the one that I was talking about, sympathetic immobilization and the immobilization of myelinated vagus, are actually co-opted for very pro-social events or processes in mammals. So I just talked about how the immobilization circuit is co-opted and now used for reproduction, nursing, and parturition. But the mobilization circuit is co-opted away from defense, and we call it play. And how do we do that? Play, if we watch people playing, it's always mobilization and then face-to-face. So they're using the social engagement system to basically make sure that the mobilization circuit is not interpreted as fighting or danger. So when people play and they accidentally hit each other, if they don't rapidly make face-to-face and diffuse it, repair the violation, you have fights.
Well, Dr. Stephen Porges, it's been my privilege to be socially engaged with you today, and I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much, Dave.
I hope you learned as much as I did in this interview. Actually, the material is fairly dense, and I know some of you listen to selected interviews more than once. This might need to be one of those, because I think we will discover as time goes by that Dr. Stephen Porges' polyvagal theory will play an important role in future conceptualizations of the social body-mind. Often the real advances in science come not so much from discrete research findings as much as the overarching theories which tie together and make sense of what previously were disparate and confusing sets of facts. Polyvagal theory provides insight into a wide range of phenomena, including the processes which underlie trauma, autism, and borderline personality. Serious students will definitely want to immerse themselves in Dr. Porges' book, The Polyvagal Theory.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Well, here it is Friday again already. Time is just flying by, and it's hard to believe it's time to get out another podcast episode. My stride has been broken this morning by having to spend a couple of hours dealing with technical support. First with my high-speed internet carrier, and then with the manufacturer of my wireless router. So I've been in phone tree hell, and now I'm trying to get my head back in the game. Sometime soon you should be seeing the next episode of Wise Counsel Podcast, which will be my interview with Dr. Kristen Neff on self-compassion, a research field that she has pioneered. So keep your eye out and your ears tuned for that one. I periodically receive friend requests on Facebook, and I'm happy to friend all my listeners. Just include a message with your friend request letting me know that you're a listener, and then I'll be sure to friend you. Sometimes I get friend requests, but I don't know if it's a listener or if it's some random person. And then once we're friends on Facebook, be sure to, quotes, like me there. For whatever it's worth, I don't know, but hey, it just involves clicking a button. If you listen to Shrink Wrap Radio but you haven't subscribed, please do so. You can subscribe in iTunes. And if you haven't left a positive review there on iTunes, you could do that too. That's always helpful. And let me remind you that another way you can listen to this show is by using the Stitcher app on your smartphone. I think I mentioned it on the last show, but it bears repeating. The app is probably available for all smartphones, so search for it in your mobile store, and it's spelled Stitcher, S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R. iTunes, it's called Stitcher Radio, and it's a free app, and it lets you listen to your favorite podcasts and radio stations without using up a lot of memory on your actual device. It works by streaming the shows to you instead of downloading them into the memory of your device. And personally, I don't mind taking up that memory space on my iPhone with recent episodes from my favorite podcasts, because streaming sometimes is intermittent and kind of stammers a bit. Once again, be sure to help evangelize about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends, your colleagues, your fellow students, relatives, and strangers in the street, because I'm convinced there's a much larger potential listenership than we've reached so far. And do remember to blog and Twitter about it and about your favorite episodes. I try to Facebook and Twitter about each episode. So you may see that if you're subscribed to my Facebook or Twitter. You can help support the show by patronizing our affiliates and enjoying the discounts that they've made available to our listeners. And you'll find links to the discounts on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com. It's important to go to the website every now and then, even if you subscribe and it appears automatically on your MP3 player. So go to our website and look for the links to shoebuy.com, forinkjets.com, and angieslist.com. I've said good things about all three of these. Forinkjets.com is something everyone can take advantage of, I think, because they provide not only discount inkjet cartridges for every variety of printer, but also toner cartridges for laser printers as well as other printer supplies. It's your go-to place for saving money on printer ink. Just click on the 4inkjets.com banner that's in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com, and it'll take you to our discount code. Your use of these discount codes does help, but in truth, it provides Shrink Wrap Radio with only a trickle of income. They do save you money, though, so you should do it for that reason. But your donations are particularly important. A relatively small number of people are helping to support this series. Won't you please add your name to the honor roll of those who give a periodic, one-time, or ongoing monthly contribution? You feel so good exercising your generosity muscles. Just go to our homepage at shrinkwrapradio.com and click on the big green donate button, and I thank you.
Hello, this is travel writer and filmmaker Rupert Isaacson, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, Rupert Isaacson, author and filmmaker, will be my next guest on Shrink Wrap Radio. More about that in a bit, but first, let's hear some of the recent feedback from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. Here's one from Christina in faraway Dubai. Dear David, I would like to tell you how much I enjoy and appreciate your podcasts. I'm a British psychotherapist working in Dubai for 12 years now, and previously in Cape Town, South Africa for many years. I live an hour's drive from Dubai, so I look forward to listening to the podcasts of your shows on the drive through the desert to and from the city, along with trying to avoid camels and goats hanging out on the empty highway. Well, that's a new one on me. She goes on to say, I recently listened to the interview with Fern Cohen on the series In Treatment, which I found really interesting having watched all three series. Today, I came across this UK symposium on In Treatment on a podcast and thought you might be interested to hear it should you not have heard about it already. And she gives a link to, you'll find it at podcastfm.co.uk. So if you search for it, I think you'll find it. She concludes, once again, thank you for a fantastic program. Best wishes. And that's from Christina in Dubai. Thanks so much, Christina, both for the link and for letting me know how much we're able to entertain and educate you as you go past those camels and goats. Next, we hear from Marshall Lewis, who is my guest, will be my guest on Logotherapy on the Wise Counsel podcast. And he writes, hi, David, just a minute ago, I sent the most recent version of the beginning of my dissertation to my chair. I thought I would send it along to you as well, just because I'm sure you have plenty of time to read this stuff. Ha ha. Hope your day is a good one. All the best, Marshall. Well, Marshall, congratulations on being so far along. It sounds like you're almost finished, that you're in the final strokes of finishing up your dissertation. So my congratulations on that. And I have to apologize to Marshall because actually he will be the star of my next Wise Counsel podcast interview rather than Kristen Neff, who I announced a couple of minutes ago. Marshall will be speaking with us about Viktor Frankl and logotherapy, so be sure to check that one out. Next, we hear from John in Ireland, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, hello again from Ireland. John Hurley here from Cork. You were kind enough to write back to the last letter I sent you. I don't know how you find the time and could learn from your time management skills. I'm just having a relaxing read over the BBC with my morning coffee, and the following two articles caught my attention. The first is a slideshow looking at the benefits of horticulture as a treatment for wounded servicemen, and I did check out that slideshow, and you can find it by going to bbc.co.uk, going to the news, and if you search for horticulture and wounded servicemen, I'm sure you'll find it. The second thing that he sent was a link in the same place on the same website about reverse SAD, that's seasonal affective disorder. He says the second is about reverse SAD, which I have not previously heard of. Interesting article with a reference to John Sharp of Harvard. So you can find that again at bbc.co.uk. He says, hope you enjoy them. I'm still enjoying both your Wise Counsel and Shrink Wrap podcasts. Keep up the good work. Yours, John Hurley. So John, thanks for sending along those links. And it's good to know that I got a faithful listener in Ireland, actually more than one. Next, we hear from another John who writes, I really enjoy your podcast and appreciate all the time and effort you put into it. I've learned so many great things from them. I was thinking David Rico might make a good guest based on his background and orientation that seems similar to yours and the guests you have on. And he gives me a link to www.daverico.com. He says, I don't know what he's like in an interview, but I've read a couple of his books, and they are packed with insightful thoughts and ideas, in particular, how to be an adult in relationships. And he signs it, John. So, John, I have added that as a possible guest suggestion to the rather long list I have already. He does sound like he could be a likely candidate. So we'll see as time goes on. And here's one last one from Tracy, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. I just wanted to tell you I really enjoyed your interview with Jerry Trumbull on hypnagogia. I'm very interested in it, and it sounds a lot like Jung's active imagination. Please do more with Jerry on hypnagogia. Thanks, and I really enjoy your show. And that's from Tracy. Tracy, I definitely am planning to follow up with Jerry. And I had not thought to link the hypnagogia to Jung's active imagination. I have to give that a little bit more thought. I think they might be different, but you may be onto something. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember to leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. On Skype, I am ShrinkPod, or you can leave a voicemail on our phone, which I haven't had happen in a long time, at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. Stephen Porges for helping us to understand his polyvagal theory. And as you heard earlier, my guest on the next episode will be filmmaker and author Rupert Isaacson, who produced the film and the book, both of which bear the title The Horse Boy, documenting his family's trek by horseback across Mongolia in search of a shaman who could heal their young son's autism. Now, this is definitely one you won't want to miss. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.